This is the Out of Water Podcast. Out of Water is a production of Rio Vista Community Church in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. If you like what you hear, please subscribe and tell a friend to help them find Out of Water also.
Welcome, folks, to another episode of the Out of Water Podcast. My name is Sam, and I will be your host today. Joining me is Will.
Good morning, Sam.
And Will, we are continuing in our, what was that, when we started this series on the Ten Commandments, one or two episodes. We should. Now we're breaking commandments into two parts. And so we're actually on the sixth commandment, which is do not murder. So today we're going to be getting into six branches off of this commandment, not to murder, and things that are lightning rods for debate. And so those six topics are going to be self-defense, the death penalty, just war theory, euthanasia, which is closely related to the next one, suicide, and finally abortion. And so we ask for your grace, you know, hear this with charitable ears. We're trying our best to represent the mind of God, which matters a lot more than the opinions of Sam and Will, and wrestle with it, you know, because ultimately God's opinion matters more than ours. Where does God land on these things? That's what we're going to discuss. You know, some of these are going to involve conversations that parents might not want their kids to listen to. So if you're in the car, it might be something that you want to, you know, do at a different time and screen. And if it is something that you think it would be good for your kids to hear later, we don't know what's going to come out of our mouths yet. And if you think it would be good for your kids and it's age appropriate for them, you know, maybe listen to it with them later. But it's important in our day and age to really wrestle and try to come down with a biblical worldview on these life and death, literally, life and death issues.
Yeah, and I think not to just gloss over the Ten Commandments too, I think what we've seen from this is as we dig deeper, there's profitable conversation to be had about these aren't just archaic commands that don't matter, but God was doing something important.
Mm-hmm.
And he's God, so we should listen. And even in these tough conversations, it's, man, we want to follow after God in a way that God would approve of.
That's right.
That would make him smile. And some of these harder conversations need to be had in this day and age where it's, hey, I can do what I want when I want as long as no one gets hurt kind of ethic. And people do get hurt, dude. It matters.
Yeah. So, and this one, like, I think there's a reason when God gives the Ten Commandments, we've talked about this before, but the first four commandments are set aside long before you get to how you're supposed to treat your neighbor. You're required to kind of come and say, okay, there's no other God but him. He is the ultimate. What he says goes. He's God. I'm not. His ethics matter more than my opinions. His law matters more than my opinions. And so I'm going to submit and surrender to him. You know, when you get to idolatry and how we represent his name and how we rest in him and all of those things, all of that has to come into this particular conversation because, you know, in a biblical worldview, it's nice for you to have your feelings and to have your emotions and to have your natural loyalties, right? Where, you know, my tribe tends to believe this. But Jesus calls you to something different, to where you have to have the heart and the mind of God first. And so if God disagrees with you, you have to submit to what God's ethics are. Because you believe God designed the world, he owns the world, and the world's going to be a more beautiful place when his will is supreme over yours. And so like last time, if you remember in our last episode that was kind of on the foundational basis of how the Bible treats murder or the sanctity of life for that matter, we talked about how every single human life belongs to God. And this command not to murder is dealing specifically with human life. It's not animals. It's not plant life. And it's an unjust taking of human life. That is the idea behind this. So that we're going to develop that as we go through this episode, but all life belongs to God. All human life bears the image of God. And then we talked about how as you go through the Old Testament, I mean, if you're really like, listen to our series in Genesis, how many of the chapters are God bringing life where life seemed impossible? It's God, you know, preventing death. It's God sparing Isaac. It's God overcoming barrenness. It's God, he's always bringing life in place of death or barrenness or despair or drought and famine. And he's the God who always brings life. And so when you imagine the character of God, you have to come into this conversation with that reigning supreme. All life belongs to God, even your own. All life is made in the image of God, so it's sacred beyond your own opinion and or your own valuations. Like, it's life is not sacred because you find it meaningful or useful. Life is valuable because it belongs to God and because you bear his image. And then lastly, like, the ethic of God is always life over death, always. That is his ethic. That's the kind of one of the main points of all of redemptive history, is a God who is bringing resurrection power to a world destined for death. And so as the people of God who mirror and echo his ethics, guess what? We are people of life, start to finish. And so where it gets tricky is it in the Bible, there are times where you take life for the sanctity of life. And that's where some of the big arguments come from, but that's going to be kind of the driving ethic behind, you know, just war or self-defense or the death penalty. Like, how does the Bible allow that? And so let's jump right in. You got anything else you want to add before we jump right into self-defense?
No, let's go.
All right. So first one, self-defense, how would you define that? So we're talking about if you're taking a life for the sake of self-defense.
Yeah. Your life has to be in danger.
Or someone your family. Yeah, yeah. Your loved ones. So that's the idea behind self-defense. And so I would argue, and I feel pretty confident, I feel like the Bible argues this pretty plainly, Exodus 22, when Moses is giving the law to Israel, one of the things he says is, if somebody comes into your home at night and he is seeking to take your life, you have the just right to take their life, to spare your own. I mean, it's pretty plain and simple, like, unless God is changing his morals in the middle of the biblical story, like, there's a license for you to defend your life or the life of your loved ones in the name of self-defense. There's another passage where you get into the New Testament, and it's actually in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 22, verse 36, where when Jesus is sending out his apostles, he tells them, if you don't have a sword, sell your cloak to buy one. Like, and it's not to fillet fish. You know, they're going into really dangerous territories. And I think in this statement, he's giving them license not to bring judgment on people, not to be murderous. That's obvious from the rest of his ministry, but to defend themselves and their loved ones that they would have been taking on these missionary trips as well. So Jesus seems to be giving license to self-defense. And what's interesting about this is it's not an obligation to defend your own life, right? Like, yeah, if somebody's coming to you and you don't want to take life and they're going to take your life, you have the option to lay down your life, but you also have the right to defend your life. Now, when you get to defending your loved ones, so let's say someone breaks into your house with a shotgun and they're on a murderous rampage and you have children and a wife to protect, then I would argue that right to defend yourself becomes an obligation, because the Bible talks about, you know, stepping up and defending those stumbling toward the slaughter, defending the weak and defenseless. Like, there's an obligation in a biblical worldview to defend life when it's in danger.
And it makes sense in the whole ethic of God, mm-hmm, right? If he's about life, like, if someone's seeking to take life, then that right exists to stop that, to end that. And we would, you know, we all know the ones that are easy to say. If a school shooter comes in,
yeah,
everybody's ready for that person. No one's saying, oh, no one should take, like, let him go.
Go give him a hug.
Yeah, no, it's like, no, you know what the Nashville guys did. I think they, mm-hmm, did a great job. They, yeah, got in there and they ended it. And that, no one was like, oh, like, so that makes sense to us.
Yeah, and it doesn't make that taking of life less tragic.
Yeah.
So, like, the Nashville shooter, the young lady that was murdered in that, who was on a murderous rampage, like, it was totally justified, 100% just. I think it was a godly decision to take her life as opposed to letting her take other lives. But at the end of the day, it should grieve the heart of a Christian that somebody, even her, who bears the image of God, lost her life.
Yeah.
You know, the shooting that just happened at Lakewood Church in Houston, where somebody came in shooting a high-powered rifle and was killed. Like, that's a justified shooting. It's tragic. You know, those people are going to be scarred from having to do that. It's going to weigh on them for the rest of their life that they had to take somebody who bears the image of God. And yet it's 100% just and every bit as tragic.
In our world, we just hate holding two things at the same time.
Right.
We hate that that was justifiable, and we have to also hold that it's tragic. Like, mm-hmm. It's really hard to do that in our world because we're so clickbaity and so hot one take. Like, you have to, you know, fall in line in this decision. You have to be so excited that that happened, or you have to be like, that should have never happened. Instead of like, no, we can hold both of those things. Justice is tragic at times from our perspective.
I'm glad they're dead. Like, like, this is a tragedy.
Yeah.
You know, if it's mental illness or whatever, like, that's tragic. Like, this is not God's design. The whole thing from start to finish is a tragedy. And yet it was the just thing for those people to defend life by taking her life. And you see that. And so one of the things where it gets tricky is there's a difference between self-defense, where you're in the middle of the crisis, where life and death is hanging on the razor's edge and you have to make that decision. At that point, the taking of human life is just, right? But now where the Bible totally says no is vigilante justice. Okay, now your life is, somebody came in and shot up the place. They got in their car. They disappeared. A week later, you find out where they're at.
Yeah.
You do not have the right, like you did in that moment, to spare life. You do not have the right to then hunt them down and kill them. That is a job that's left for the government, right? Like, it is the government at that point that imposes the law. It imposes justice, because outside of the moment of crisis, self-defense is no longer on the table, right? Like, I can't, if somebody hurt somebody in my home, I can't just form the mob, get the torches, and go, you know, impose justice. The Bible's very clear on that. In fact, in the Old Testament, the same law that is giving you the right to kill someone who breaks into your home and is seeking to harm you and your family says, establishes sanctuary cities for people who accidentally caused death so that they wouldn't be put to death hastily and they got fair justice. So the Bible's very much against vigilante justice, because if the mob is in control, there's no stability for society. If you get to say, you know what, I think this person should die for what they did, and it's not to protect life in the moment, then society, the fabric of society, falls apart if we just become the vigilante mob, you know. And that's when cities are on fire and people are, you know, getting lynched. And all through history, you find this in every culture. When the fabric of society starts tearing apart and people feel deprived of justice, that's when you see this, and it's not the godly solution. You are not allowed to take individual justice issues in your hand and then go murder people.
Yeah, vengeance is mine, says the Lord.
That's it. I mean, really. And so the hope of the Christian is, you know, I'm trusting in the government to carry out justice. So we're in number two now, the death penalty. And the Bible is, I mean, good grief, if you just read the civil law that is handed down to Moses and just go through the book of Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy, and you see the number of times where God says, if this starts happening, death is the result. Well, why does he do that? Is he a God that doesn't value life? No. Every time where you see the death penalty on the table, it is because if this falls apart in society, life is so degraded, the sanctity and the dignity of life is so degraded in societies that let go of these ethics, that to protect the sanctity of life, we need to hold the line in a very, very hard way. Now, our death penalty in the United States is way more lax than it was back in the theocratic days of Israel. And that's, you know, I think not necessarily a bad thing, but it is more. And the Bible in the New Testament, so you got all of that in the Old Testament. You'd have a hard time saying the Old Testament is against the death penalty, right? It
comes out pretty often.
But when you get to the New Testament, it's still there. So, I mean, when we get to Romans chapter 13 and the Apostle Paul is talking about the role of the state, the role of the government, it says, let every person be subject to governing authorities. Like God, and he talks about how God has appointed these people to be over you. and that they're instituted by God to do good, which becomes interesting for a later conversation, right? Governments are instituted to hold the fabric of society together to make sure that it doesn't devolve into this immoral, gross, lawless, chaotic anarchy. But listen to what he says. He says, do what is good, and you will receive his approval, meaning the state or the king. For he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, listen to what he says. Be afraid, for he, meaning the king, the state, the government, does not bear the sword in vain. What does that mean?
It's the death penalty.
That's right.
To...
So Paul is not like, oh, the king bears the sword. What a great injustice. We need to stop this. This is unbiblical. Like, no, he's saying, hey, you need to fear God and honor the king, and you need to obey the laws of your society, assuming they're not calling you to rebellion to God, because the king doesn't bear the sword in vain. Like, if you break the law, if you do things that tear apart the fabric of society, he bears the sword, and that is ordained by God, by the way, so that he can impose justice, so that the state can impose justice. Why? To protect the dignity of life. Because you could say, hey, we're never going to impose justice. It's like one of the things that's driving me crazy about our country right now with these DAs that just allow horrible crimes and horrible criminals to get away with nothing. And what starts happening? You feel the fabric of society starting to peel away and everything becomes lawless. And now life is like, it's not secure. Property's not secure. You know, the human dignity is not secure. It makes everything worse. And what this is saying is, beyond just, you know, protecting your pulse, there is a dignity to human life that is so valuable that justice has to be imposed to prevent the fabric of society from falling apart.
Yeah, and the government's been given that.
And so, like, a lot of people will say, and this is the go-to argument, you know, you've heard it said in the, you know, the Old Testament, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say to you, and Jesus comes and he gives a different ethic. Turn the other cheek, forgive your enemies, pray for them, which is one of the most revolutionary ethics shifts in the New Testament, right? That is not talking to the government. So you have to have in your brain that when Jesus comes to you and says, if somebody comes and does wrong to you, as an individual, if your life's not in jeopardy and the lives of your children and your family are not in jeopardy, what do you have an obligation to do?
Let the government handle it.
You let the government handle it because vengeance belongs to the Lord, and the Lord institutes governments, right? The Lord put the sword in the king's hand for that reason, to be his representative of justice on the earth. And he institutes those governments. But as an individual, if somebody comes to me, vengeance doesn't belong to me. As a Christian, you know, when it says, you know, if somebody strikes you on one cheek, turn the other cheek. The idea there is not, oh, be a doormat or shame them. Or it's saying, like back in that culture, when you would find somebody, somebody comes to your house and you greet them, in that culture, you would kiss them on both cheeks, right? And what it's saying is, if somebody strikes you on the one cheek, don't give up on that relationship. Mm-hmm. Give them a chance to redeem it by kissing your other cheek. It's not saying, hey, that didn't hurt, hit this side. Like, that's not what that is saying at all. It's saying, as an individual, you always have to have the imagination of hope that relationships can be redeemed. Vengeance is not yours. You do not carry grudges. You've been forgiven great. So always have a mind toward mercy and let the government. And you can, by the way, you can want justice. It's, if somebody punches you in the face, the loving thing is to want them to face justice, because otherwise they're going to learn that it's okay to punch people in the face. We've lost that as a society, right? Like, the idea that justice is loving, we don't believe that anymore as a culture. We need to recapture that, because it's, if somebody offends you, you're always wanting their redemption. You want the relationship restored, but it doesn't mean that you're not pursuing justice. But the justice belongs to the state.
Yeah, and for me personally, when we were talking about this off air, but just the practicality of how it's carried out in a lot of ways raises questions. Like, I fully believe the biblical ethic. And like you said, our form of American government, beyond a reasonable doubt, does go pretty far. Just it's weighing those options of, man, they have gotten it wrong, and kind of doing soul work for you personally on, like, what's the line for me? Mm-hmm. So I think that is interesting. But, yeah, the Bible makes it very clear
Yeah, and part of that is we live in a self-governing republic, right? We get to elect our leaders who then represent us, and they come up with the laws. And so in years past, the threshold for death penalty was far lower than it is now. And I mean, it's always been reasonable doubt in the history of America, but now you have more states that have chosen, you know what, we're not going to do the death penalty, or it's only going to be for the most extreme of cases. You know, so it depends on sensibilities, but I would say that now in America, even though you do have wrongful convictions and you have these tragic cases where somebody, you know, DNA proves their innocence after they've been in jail for long periods of time or even after they've been executed, I would say that our success rate today is far greater than it's ever been in history in our justice system, with the tools and forensics and everything else that we have versus what it used to be, where it's like on the testimony of two or three witnesses. Well, there's a lot of margin of error back then. Now we've got, you know, fingerprints and we've got DNA and we've got video cameras. And so our certainty of yep. justice is at least a lot higher than what it used to be. But that didn't negate God allowing the death penalty, and in fact sanctioning it for the nation of Israel back in the day. And that gets back to our discussion at the first, like if you have a visceral response to the death penalty, I get it.
Yeah,
you know, because it's like, hey, they're made in the image of God and all life belongs to God and they're valuable, but the Lord understands that the sanctity of life sometimes requires the taking of life that endangers the sanctity of life and the fabric of society. And so his opinion matters more than mine. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't always have to feel good, and it shouldn't.
Yeah.
None of these should feel good.
Correct.
Like, these aren't rosy topics that we're talking about. They're the most extreme serious topics you can get into. So that's why it's like, yeah.
Trepidatious even coming into this podcast, like, yeah, we're probably going to offend a lot of people with this one, but we're trying to stay like, listen, you know, don't shoot the messengers. Like, we're trying to represent who God is in the scriptures to the best of our ability. And I promise you that God reveres life more than we do and more than anybody listening to the podcast does. And we, as people of life, when we're talking about the death penalty, Christians should understand that God does ordain it, you know, in situations like even going back to Noah. Remember our last time we talked about Genesis 9, where God says, if you shed blood, your blood's going to be shed. You know, that's sanctioned. And yet, as people of life, we need to be the ones that are the most vocal for justice to make sure that people are not being wrongfully executed or wrongfully punished, because we're people of justice and we should have a great burden to make sure that the innocent are fairly treated.
Yeah, what's that great, the Innocence Project? Like, there are great people that are working really hard to overturn wrongful convictions, and they're having success and they're finding it and they're doing a good job. So there is part of that in a free republic that we are. There's going to be a natural response to the government where people are cleaning up after them.
Yeah. And I mean, my response is, I mean, just by nature of how my flesh is wired, when I see somebody doing a horrific crime, I want them, like, I feel the vengeance. Like, I want them destroyed with relish. Like, I, you know, that's the flesh side of me. And yet it is a good thing. You know, sometimes it can go to extremes, but like the appeals process and making absolutely sure that you have done this correctly and giving every benefit of the doubt and all of the appeals process, like as a legal system that's established, no human legal system is going to be perfect. Yep. You know, there's one judge who sees to the heart, who can make all of these without error. Humans are always going to have errors in our judgment. We're always going to come to situations, you know, having preconceived ideas of what happened, or, you know, having a verdict in mind before the trial even starts. Like, that's just the natural human condition. And so knowing our brokenness, we need to devise a system of justice that really takes into account all of those things and makes sure that the accused, which, by the way, like, one of the things about American justice system that I love is you're supposed to be innocent until proven guilty.
Yep.
Like, most, that's not the case in so many cultures around the world. Like, we defer so much to the accused, which sometimes feels cruel to the victims. And yet we give every avenue of appeal and opportunity for the accused to defend themselves. So all of these are related, right? If somebody's coming into your home and you have the right to defend yourself, but once there's no longer a threat, then that goes over to the government, the state, the court system, law enforcement, and then you get into the discussion of the death penalty because that is no longer yours once you're no longer in threat. But then if you take this same issue and you expand it large to where it's not one guy coming into your home, we're talking nation against nation. This is where the early church, and this is where like I can understand this more. The early church really struggled with whether or not Christians should be a part of the Roman military. Even today, like at the founding of our nation, there were pacifist denominations at the founding of America that were like, we are not going to serve in the military. And the military, you know, even when we would have drafts, there were conscientious objectors, you know, Quakers and whatever, that identified as pacifists and said, I will never, ever, ever kill in war. And they held a deep conviction that that was a violation of the sixth commandment. Like, and I think that's a noble thing. It's a noble interpretation. But the early church fathers, St. Augustine, came out with just war theory going back to the very first centuries of the church. And that's been something that has been held ever since. And so just war theory kind of goes something like this. And you can imagine it almost as the same as some of our previous conversations, that if a nation, if a power, if a threat is doing so much to harm society to where it begins to impact the sanctity of life, you have an obligation as a nation to stand up for the sanctity of life by taking life. And that sounds like, whoa. But, you know, the easy example would be, because this was a clearly just war, Hitler.
Yeah.
You know, who you have this megalomaniacal tyrant, a fascist that's just swallowing up land, and he's imposing these unbelievable draconian standards on people, and he's rounding up the Jews and the disabled and the gypsies, and he's just throwing them through gas chambers or putting them in mass graves. And even without some of the world knowing that yet, you see this evil that's spreading, and it is going to do more damage to the sanctity of all human life if he remains unopposed than if you go to war and kill German soldiers to stop him. Again, tragic. There's no rejoicing in shooting a Nazi. There should not be, if you understand the gravity of how sacred human life is. You grieve over the fact that they were deluded into such wickedness. Mm-hmm. You grieve over the fact that their death was made necessary by this evil. But you don't rejoice that a life is taken, ever. And if we ever get to a point where life is so cheap that it's easy to take because we hate that much, and we're able to dissociate the idea that, you know, God made this person. They bear the image of God. They were somebody's son or daughter. Like, they're precious to somebody, and somebody's going to be heartbroken that they've lost a son or a daughter or a dad or a mom. Like, whenever we begin to treat life as cheap, society becomes really one that's not, you don't want to live in anymore. And so just war theory comes, and it deals with this very heavy thing. Like, is it worth us putting our own sons and daughters in the way of potentially losing their life and being scarred by post-traumatic stress disorder and everything that they're going to see in war, to go overseas and to take other lives? And so you have to take the justice of what's at stake for the sake of humanity and weigh it against the cost of going to war. And if the dignity of human life is going to be more protected by going to war than not, you have an obligation to go to war. That's the idea behind it. And then in the course of that war, just war theory brings in and says, you have to afford dignity to people. That's why, like, surrendering soldiers, you can't just indiscriminately execute. You can't, you know, put people through unnecessary tortures because you hate them in battle so much. You can't, like, there is dignity to life even among the enemies. That's where you get like the Geneva Convention that comes along and says, you know, there are standards to how you fight that protect human dignity. Well, where does that ethic come from? Like, that, I mean, that has to have a religious basis, because otherwise, why not? Why not just mow them down with the most efficient bombs and poisons and tortures and however? Like, the reason why we still have some semblance of those ethics in the midst of war, like we're talking about war where you want people to die so that you can win, and yet there's still ethics in how you treat them, that comes solely from this idea that there is dignity to all human life, even those that are corrupted by evil. There's dignity to all human life because it belongs to God and they're made in his image.
Yeah, I thought the interesting part about just war theory, just as we've been reading about it more, is that it's not just a decision to go to war, but it's keeping checking in on what is happening.
Right.
Like, it's one that's saying, okay, is this still proportional? Is this still desiring the intended outcome? Have we gone too far? That was the first time I've ever thought about that. For me, just war has always been like the first time that Congress is like, let's go to war.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, that's it. But no, there's parts before you go to war, during war, and even after war that's like, no, we got to keep on checking in on this, which I thought, oh, that's really wise. Mm-hmm.
And that's why, like, if you look back through our history in warfare, you know, after the Civil War, it wasn't like, okay, we win. You know, the North wins and the South is totally decimated. Like, just war extends to after the war. And what does the United States, we go through this big process of reconstruction to give dignity to the South, to let them know that they still have a place in the government and that they're, you know, in a sense, part of the national family. Like, after dropping bombs in Japan and everything else, we go back to make sure that the Japanese economy and infrastructure is rebuilt. Like, so in all senses, well, why did we do that? Like, apart from some, you know, lingering Christian worldview that influences those decisions, why do you care what your enemy does? I mean, I guess there's partly some selfish idea that if you help them, they're less likely to retaliate. But it's because those people are made in the image of God and they're entitled to dignity, and you don't want humans to suffer anywhere as a result of an evil that took their minds, or some, you know, idiot emperor that thinks he's God, or, you know, a Hitler. Like, you don't want humanity to be stuck in that bondage. And so you want to shine light. You want to show dignity. You want to see redemption, and you want to imagine that your enemies can be won as friends. And that's why, you know, we, at the same time, we have to be wise as serpents and harmless as doves, you know, where we don't empower our enemies by, you know, being like, what's his name? Chamberlain, you know, before World War II, that's like, oh, you know, he's great. We shouldn't go to war. We shouldn't stand against Hitler, you know, that was kind of born out of cowardice, and it made the war harder in the long run because it allowed him to gain in strength before he was confronted. And so, yeah, what you're talking about with just war, it's a complicated thing. And reasonable, godly people can land at different conclusions given the same, you know, I remember back after 9/11, all the debates about should we go to war, should we go to Afghanistan, should we go to Iraq? And I would find people that were incredibly godly, really wise, that landed diametrically opposed to one another. And yet it's like, okay, these are hard decisions. It's not, hey, you disagree with me, you're evil. You know, you should never enter war lightly, ever, because war is entirely unpredictable. And one of the dangers when you enter into a war, even when everything up front, this looks just, you never know how the war is going to evolve and what new elements of suffering come in, or what allies emerge against and your enemies. And you don't know how it's going to turn out. It could really, really bring hell to your own people and to others. And so, like, that's one of the parts of deciding all that is you can't script how war is going to go. Anytime you open that box, human life is really, really endangered. So you have to be committed to not just engage the war, but to win the war decisively for the cause of righteousness, with a strategy to leave the people better than you found them.
Yeah, which is why Congress has the power, not the president, because that's too much power for one person to yield.
That's right.
Which I think was obviously very smart of the Constitution.
Yeah, they were smart guys. And by the way, like, that, one of the other things that you find as you go through the scriptures is there are times where the Lord very plainly instructs his people to go to war. You know, I just did a Bible study not long ago in Judges where Gideon, God finds Gideon hiding in the wine press as foreign enemies are invading the land and degrading all of their people. And God says, hey, get out of the wine press. Stop hiding. Stop being a coward. Go get an army and let's go. So, like, the Lord is saying there are times to fight. Ecclesiastes says there are seasons for peace and there are seasons for war. And a broken world, sadly, those are necessary. The trick is finding how do you do that in the most godly way possible that honors the dignity of life, even as you're calling people to take it. So we've hit self-defense, we hit the death penalty, we just talked about just war theory and what that means and how a Christian should reason his way through the scriptures to understand the character of God and those things. The next one is euthanasia. And euthanasia is when society comes along and either one of two ways, either society says these people are too sickly and, as Germany would call them, useless eaters, or, you know, people that just are a drain on society. The Romans, every culture going back before the Christian ethics spread around, seemed to have some version of this where you found somebody and it was what, life unworthy of life is one of the expressions that you'll find in these different societies going throughout time. And Christianity stands resolutely against the concept of euthanasia. So, like, in the Roman tables of the law, where, you know, if you have a deformed infant, you're required by the law to kill it. Mm-hmm. In Sparta, they would throw, you know, sickly babies off of cliffs. And in China, they're still with the one-child policy. You have huge numbers of infanticide. You find that all over the place. When Christianity came along, they said that the idea of euthanasia was done. Like, there was nobody too sickly, there was nobody too poor, there was nobody too quote-unquote useless to where their life no longer mattered. Why not? Well, it gets back to the premise of everything that we've said so far, which is your life doesn't belong to you. It belongs to God. All human life is made in the image of God. Therefore, you don't have a right to take it unless God has sanctioned you to do so. And he is a God that promotes life, not death. And so what is euthanasia? When Hitler begins a T-34 program or whatever it was called, where he begins to euthanize the sickly or the mentally ill, or no, like, that life does not belong to you. You are not allowed to do that. And then there's also, so euthanasia is just very clearly standing against the Judeo-Christian ethics. I think that's pretty obvious. Like, you can't round up people that you find defective or claim life unworthy of life and say, I make the call to deliver them when they've done nothing morally wrong. Mm-hmm. Like, there's nothing about their life that warrants death apart from the fact that they're not as great as you are.
Yeah. And I think our society's made this confusing when it starts to become where we've twisted it to be a mercy thing with physician assisted suicide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that gets us to suicide because they're cousins, right?
Yeah.
Where we're at in society is that you don't have a megalomaniacal tyrant saying, I'm going to round up the sickly. We have a society that's falling into despair that says, I think my life is unworthy of life, and therefore I want to take it. And the government says, let us help you with that.
Yeah.
And so you see that in certain states. I remember Oregon, you know, the Death with Dignity Act, you know, decades ago, they were the first ones to come out. Now Canada is, you know, big on the euthanasia train. A lot of westernized nations are allowing for assisted suicide. And now, you know, well-intentioned, very, you know, otherwise seemingly moral people are like, I would rather die than suffer some long, terrible disease like cancer or Lou Gehrig's disease. You know, it's none of your business. You should allow them to die when they want to die. And that's operating under the presumption that their life belongs to them. Right? And the ethic of the Christian church, which had been rock solid for centuries, was that you do not have the right to take your own life. Your life doesn't belong to you. God made it. God created it. It's his choice when you go home. You know, you're not under any obligation to take, you know, extraordinary heroic measures to keep your life going. You know, you're not obligated to be on the machine or whatever, but you do not have the right to take your own life. That's super, again, abundantly clear in the Bible to me.
Yeah, that's why our ethic about suffering has to change too. Like, our world comes to us and says, we need to avoid suffering at all costs. That's not worthwhile. That's not part of the plan, that you don't deserve this. And I don't want to downplay suffering, because a lot of people out there are suffering really hard from very tough things. But God comes to us and says, your pain is worthwhile. Your suffering is worthwhile. You don't need to end this. That you have to believe that my providence has led you to this place, and I will sustain you. Mm-hmm. And that's difficult, and that's hard. And
yeah. We don't find purpose in suffering. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the sadder parts of where we're allergic to suffering as a culture, because we cannot see any beauty in it. Mm-hmm. Where even in the midst of suffering, God is doing things, even though, you know, I wouldn't wish them on me or my family or anyone that I love. Like, I don't like suffering. And yet God is ultimately in control, and your life belongs to him, and there's something for you in that suffering. And the Bible, you know, like, just in addressing this, so I'm a melancholic person, which means I, you know, I'm all over the place emotionally. I have highs and lows and, you know, tears and sadness, and I'm all over the map when it comes to that. I used to not be this kind of softy, but now I am. And in ministry, when you're walking through things that are hard, you know, there've been seasons, and I'll just be candid. Like, I've never felt suicidal, but there've been many seasons where it's like, I wish I could just die right now. Like, I'm tired and I don't want to do this, and life is hard and this is sad and I don't like what I'm going through. And I used to feel like terrified by that. And then once you start to gain a greater grasp of the Bible, you come across people like Elijah, who says, I don't want to do this anymore. Mm. Whoa, Elijah? Moses, I don't want to do this anymore. Job, it would have been better for me not to be born. Or Paul, I despaired of life. You have all of these people that are the greatest heroes of the Bible, that because God has called them to do big things are hard. Mm. You know, setting down your interests calls you into seasons where sometimes it's not pleasant. It brings about suffering. It brings about loneliness. It brings about hard things. And yet what I love is that when Paul comes to that point where he says, I despaired of life, like, translation, I didn't want to do this anymore. What does he say? Like, God, you brought me to that point where I despaired of life so that you could show the power of your resurrection in me. Mm-hmm. In that suffering, you had something for me that now I wouldn't trade for anything in the world. It took a long time. I had to wrestle through it. God only knows how long that season was for Paul. But on the other side of that suffering, where he didn't want to live anymore, God had done a beautiful thing, delivered him from it. And now he had learned to relate to God and life in a way that was far more beautiful. And so, like, when we're in those seasons, it's not abnormal to be like, man, this is hard. But our culture now lives in a ethic that says, well, if you don't want to do it, just stop doing it. You know, it's your life. Do what you want to do. And it's a gross despair, and it's a perversion of the sanctity of life that says there's no hope beyond my own opinion right at this moment. Mm-hmm. And any irrational thought can lead me to do one of the most tragic things imaginable, which is to take my own life and to leave behind waves of suffering that are inevitably going to result from that idea. But it ignores this idea that, well, wait a minute, your life doesn't belong to you. You didn't make it. You didn't create it. You didn't sustain it. Like, you belong to God. You're made in the image of God. You are sacred. You do not have a right to take your own life, period. It is an ungodly thing to do unless you're laying down your life for the good of someone else. Mm. The Bible will commend that. But laying down your life just to avoid suffering because you have no hope, that you may not do.
Yeah, it's so twisted that we live in a world where you can't show weakness. Because, mm-hmm. like you were talking about, the Bible is showing us more of their weakness than anything else. And so as a church, that is kind of an informative thing. Like, that's something we can regain. Like, hey, we want to walk alongside you in your weakness. Like, mm-hmm. we all feel these things at certain times, you know, different ways and different situations. But, like, none of us are standing up here thinking like, oh, I'm just going to, you know, strength all the time. I'm okay.
No, that's not the human experience. You know, in our social media world where we want to, you know, show everybody that we've got it all together and we have the perfect life and nobody wants to show weakness. And we're always hiding behind fig leaves and masks and nobody knows the real us. that is outrageously lonely. You're not meant to live like that. You're meant to live with people who know your vulnerabilities, who see your ugly spots and love you anyway, and can give you hope to walk through those seasons with the hope that there's a brighter day, even if you have a terminal illness that's incurable. There in Christ, there is a brighter day to come. But you still do not have, and this is hard to say because, man, people that are in the throes of those suffering, like if I was in that suffering, I would want God to take my life.
Yeah.
That I might pray for God to take my life if my existence had been reduced to nothing but pain and I can't talk and I can't move and I can't do anything that seems to have purpose. So what we do is say, if you can't do something, your life has no meaning.
Hmm.
No. Your life has meaning because you're made by God. You bear his image. You have meaning in and of yourself, regardless of whether or not you can perform things. And that's what we've gotten away from. And that, by the way, is that's why the suicide rate is through the roof, as we don't allow for imperfections, like you said. We don't allow for weakness. We believe that our value and utility is just in what we can perform. So the moment that gets hindered or disrupted or jeopardized, what's the point of living anymore? Well, no, the point of living is you are sacred. You are precious to God. You are not your own. And so whatever season God is calling you in, you have reason to hope because you belong to him. And even in the suffering, God might be bringing something beautiful through it.
Yeah, I think it's a good reminder for all of us that if you are the one currently in the suffering, you know, reach out to somebody.
For sure.
And don't suffer quietly and alone. And if you're listening to the podcast and you know that someone's suffering, maybe now's the time for a phone call or a text, mm-hmm. You know, in those seasons, the smallest of things can mean so much.
Yeah. And I can tell you, when I went through seminary, I've probably said this before, but when I went through seminary, you know, they teach you how to do certain things. And you really can't do them until you're in the middle of them. You really don't learn, you know, reading a book or whatever, or doing mock sermons. But I used to say, like, you know, I'm excited about doing weddings. I'm excited about preaching. I enjoy counseling. But gosh, I don't ever want to have to do a suicide funeral, because we had to write a funeral sermon and then write a suicide funeral sermon. And it was like, you know, and of the first 13 funerals that I did, 7 of them were suicides. And, you know, I say that, I'm going to make 2 notes here. One, you don't know the suffering you leave behind. And you see, you know, for this person who felt utterly worthless and enough to where they would take their own life, you see just how valuable they were in the tears and agony of those they leave behind. Like, they were loved. I've yet to do one of those funerals where people are not devastated. And so it's not just, it's an ultimately selfish thing to take your life, because you're heaping really devastating pain into the lives of those around you, which, by the way, I can promise you, your life is not valueless in the sight of God or in the sight around you. And so suicide is really selfish. But I'll say this on the other side of that. This is something I used to get asked when I was teaching at WA all the time. You know, there had been a teaching that seeped in largely through the Catholic Church that suicide was, you know, an unforgivable sin, that if you did it, it was a ticket straight to hell. And that's a horrible teaching.
Yeah.
That's just not true. You know, there is a sense in which suicide, you know, it can be a mental illness. Now, the Christian is called to hope. And so if you're a Christian of faith, you persevere, you go through it, like you ultimately trust for God to redeem things, you hang on, you will not let go, there's perseverance to it. But at the same time, suicide is often caused by something that's physiologically wrong, you know, chemicals in the brain that are not right. There's all kinds of diagnoses that go into that. And so to say that a physiological condition deserves everlasting punishment any more than a Christian who dies of cancer, you know, or something else that's physiologically wrong, means that God has no choice but to pronounce judgment. No, I know solid believers that probably had some physiological things go wrong with them, that succumbed to the despair and took their life. And I'm confident, like, the mercy of God has them. He didn't lose them because of a physiological condition that changed their brain makeup or chemicals. And so, you know, there's always hope for redemption. And all of these, by the way, there's hope of the gospel that infuses all of that. And you can never say about a person, well, they forfeited salvation because they made that choice. That's horrible theology, honestly. It's not good. It shows that faith was shaky at a minimum. But you can always hope. It's the Lord who saves. It's not your good works. That's what we believe about the gospel, right?
Yeah, if you didn't earn it, you can't give it away.
That's right. That's exactly right. But now we get to abortion. And abortion, like, this is the hot topic. I mean, this is what divides people, divides homes, gets people angry. So I'm going to say this with compassion, because the stats show that somewhere between 25% and 40% of all women, adult women living in the United States, have had an abortion. And so there is no doubt in my mind that people who hear this podcast have had this and are probably going, what are they going to say? What are they going to say? Trembling. And so I want to start by saying, you know, the Lord's forgiveness and mercy extends to everybody. But there is a truth behind this subject that I can't reconcile any other way. And that is that abortion is a violation of the sixth commandment. It is the taking of a human life. It would qualify as murder in the sight of God. And it goes against all of the things that I see in the nature of God, which is that all life is created by him. It belongs to him. It's not ours to take unless he gives consent. It violates that one. All life is made in the image of God. It is sacred because it bears his image. Abortion is the deliberate destruction of beings that bear the image of God. And then lastly, the ethic of God is for life to overcome. It's for life to flourish. And abortion is the deliberate taking of life and preventing life from growing old and maturing. It suffocates it at its inception and infancy. And so, like, I cannot, when I consider the ethics of God, take all the political side of this out. That is a culture of death. And almost invariably, the arguments that you'll hear in response will be, you know, what if the life of the mother is at stake? And I've heard very, very brilliant theologians, men who I respect, say, you know, this gets back to that question of, you know, the value of life. Can you take life for the sake of protecting the sanctity of life? I think I land on trusting in God's sovereignty on all of this, right? But there are people who believe, okay, for the life of the mother, that's more sacred. I don't agree, but I understand that one.
Yeah.
The issue of rape, you know, where a woman is impregnated by rape, and this is one that will get me hate mail, but that doesn't justify the taking of a life. It's awful. It is unjust. It is evil to the bone to take a woman and to rape her, to put her through that. I totally understand that it's traumatizing, and it sounds heartless to say this, and I know that's the way that it's going to be interpreted by some. But again, if you were to stand before the Lord of Glory and you had a conversation with him, not Sam in a podcast, and you said, okay, God, I've just undergone one of the most traumatic things imaginable. It is crushing. It is thoroughly disorienting every part of me, and I am deeply scarred and wounded in this. And now I have this life that's yours, that's made in your image. I think in wrestling with God, what would you hear him say there?
Yeah, I think with all the tenderness that only God could give in that moment, it would still be that life is life.
Yeah.
And he knit that baby together in a womb in a tragic way, you know, if the circumstances leading up to that. Mm-hmm. But still.
And it's this unbelievable calling that no woman has asked for, but it's very Christ-like to endure suffering for the sake of giving life to another. That feels wild to say. And I again, like, please give me grace for in talking about this, because I know this is hitting, you know, hearts that are tender and hurting, and maybe somebody's walked through this. But, you know, that life that God has created through this is not guilty. It bears his image. It's his. You know, there's beauty that can come out of this, and understandably, that's costly. But beyond just rape or the life of a mother, the overwhelming vast majority of abortions, over 99%, are decisions to prevent it from impacting life, career, shame of a parent. It's things like that. And in those cases, it's just not even up for discussion. The Lord sees that as murder. I'm utterly convinced of that. When you look through the Bible and you see the Lord talk about the unborn, the word brephos, which is used as baby in the New Testament, it does not distinguish between a baby that's born, a toddler that's running around, or a baby and Elizabeth that's sleeping in the womb. It's the same word. The Bible recognizes this is a baby. It talks about being knit together in the mother's womb. At Jeremiah 1:5, you know, before I knew you, I formed you in your inward parts. Like, the Bible does not differentiate between the unborn and the born. And the reality is, like, you know, you hear arguments, and this, I don't even want to talk about this, because ultimately life belongs to God, and that should be enough for the believer, right?
Yeah.
Life is made in the image of God. That should be enough for the believer to hear. But you get into, you know, when we get into the details of, you know, okay, well, let's talk about the development of life. Okay, at conception, you know, you have all the DNA and the blueprint of life is there. Then at 3 to 4 weeks, you've got a heartbeat. And 5 weeks, you've got brain waves. And 8 weeks, you get all the systems of the baby that are present and functioning. They just need time to grow. Like, and so we try to parse out and say, well, you know, I think that if you get to this week, then it's worthy of protection. And humanity starts getting in this business like, I am the one who determines when life becomes sacred, and it's my opinion. And yikes, because Hitler did that. Like, who is it that says human life is up for discussion and we get to be the arbiters that say, well, at 19 weeks, suddenly it's sacred, or at birth? You know, some people think that abortion should be available to birth. That's monstrous to me. I will sound harsh. So you can shoot the messenger on that one. If you believe in second and third trimester abortions with no caveat, that's monstrous.
Yeah.
Like, it's barbaric to look at. But what I want us to get to is, just because it looks grosser and the baby looks more developed doesn't mean that a first trimester is any less of an offense to God. Did he not make that? Is it not in his image? Has he not willed it? Is he not God? Is he not sovereign? And when we start like that, that should settle this whole issue before we ever get into the discussions of development and, you know, people saying, oh, the baby, you know, it's location determines whether or not it's available for life. Like, if it's born, then it's sacred. But if it's still in the womb, you know, 2 days apart, it can still be killed. Or that does not matter to me. You know, most abortions now actually take place very, very early on, and they're not with the more barbaric, you know, like they used to have the saline solution abortion where the baby was burned to death in the womb, or the dilation and curettage, or dilation and evacuation, where, you know, the baby is literally getting sucked to pieces or ripped apart with forceps, or the partial birth abortion where they like stab a baby in the back of the head and collapse its skull with a vacuum to suck the brain out and then deliver the baby. Like, we live in a society where this is debatable. What is wrong with us and our view of the sanctity of life? Like, no, wake up. We need smelling salts to get us back to the place where, even if it's a pill with a baby that doesn't have all of its systems, or a baby that barely is showing brain waves, it does not matter. Mm-hmm. At conception, God has laid forth a blueprint on that baby. That baby, even at the cellular level, bears the image of God. It is his design. It is his will. It is his creation. It is his construction. Who are we to believe that we bear the sovereign choice to kill that? I can't get around that. I'm sure I'm making people mad. But I really firmly believe that I stand on the Lord's side on this one. And so you can be mad at me, but wrestle with him.
Yeah, this is one where you have to ask ourselves, you know, will I be angry at what makes God angry? And I think this does. Especially the flippant nature that we have about it and about life these days.
I was looking at the number of abortions that have been committed since 1973 is 65 million. That's the agreed upon consensus.
Is that America?
That's just us. That's just the United States. So I want you to imagine this. If a foreign enemy, just to understand the scope of what we've done, if a foreign enemy wiped out the entire populations of the following states, abortion still has a greater death toll. So imagine this. Foreign enemy wipes out Alabama, Louisiana, Kentucky, Oregon, Oklahoma, Connecticut, Utah, Iowa, Nevada, Arkansas, Kansas, Mississippi, New Mexico, Nebraska, Idaho, West Virginia, Hawaii, New Hampshire, Maine, Montana, Rhode Island, Delaware, South Dakota, North Dakota, Alaska, the District of Columbia, Vermont, and Wyoming. All life in every single one of those states is wiped out. It still falls short of the death toll of abortion. So we talk about this very flippantly, but if those lives matter to God, if they belong to him, if they bear his image, if they're human souls, our Holocaust in our country is far worse and far more horrific than anything the Nazis did. Hmm. And our conscience is so hardened that we don't lose sleep over it. We go into presidential elections thinking, I don't talk about this. Don't talk about this. This is unpopular to discuss. This is not a winning political thing. And let me just say, I don't give two turds about the political implications of this. I think God calls upon his people to defend life, to speak out for all defenseless, for all those stumbling toward the slaughter, to stand in and say, no, life is valuable. There's human souls. These are made by God in the image of God. Just as we would go to defend the outcast, just as we would go to defend the weak, the disabled, these beings that are being murdered at such astronomical rates in the womb have nobody to speak on their behalf. Church, that's our job.
I think if and when we do that, and we should, we also have to work hard at the practical implications of we need to give money to places like Hope Women's Center.
Mm-hmm.
We need to support the work of that. We need to provide for these women who find themselves in these situations. Like, are we all ready to adopt a kid? Are we all ready to, you know, move into those kinds of things? And
yeah, and I mean, one of the accusations is we have to be people that care about life after it's born, mm-hmm. too. And so supporting those ministries. Right now, the estimates are there's between 1 and 2 million people in our country that are waiting to adopt.
Hmm.
That's a crazy number. We make that so complicated and so expensive and so prohibitive to people that are unable to have children of their own that would love to have children. Like, we need to get better about building a culture that values life and takes care of life and supports people that are struggling, that feel desperate with this decision, because it is, I got 4 children. Like, it's no small undertaking. It's a beautiful one. It's one of the greater callings God has given to me in life. It is scary, and the church needs to be there for people who feel the whispers of hopelessness or despair or terror of what this is going to do to their life. Like, that's where the church gets to shine. It's not just saying, hey, life is valuable. It's showing life is valuable at all stages along the way and being a people that celebrates the sanctity of life, not just in preventing the taking of it, but celebrates life that as it's being lived out, it has dignity. It is shown great worth, that there is nobody expendable, that nobody's thrown into the type of life that's just demeaning.
Yeah.
And that, like the church, if you're going to speak out on abortion, you got to put your money, your time, and your heart where your mouth is, because you can't just say, go deal with this, you know, good luck. Like, these, you need to be, like you said, you know, supporting those ministries and engaging those ministries that really do offer hope. you know, and to show my cards, like I've been in the pro-life movement. This has been an issue that has been near and dear to my heart ever since I was a kid. I remember in middle school, we were allowed to write a paper, and I didn't have strong convictions one way or another, but my next door neighbor was the chairwoman of Indian River County Right to Life up in Vero Beach, Florida. And so I was thinking, hey, I don't have to go to the library. She's got lots of resources. It's basically driven out of laziness. And so I thought, oh, I'll go get all my research from her and I'll write it on abortion. So she loaded me up with a lot of stuff. And before I left, she says, do you know which position you're going to take? And I was like, because I was talking to her, I was like, well, probably pro-life, but you know, I don't know. And she was like, can I show you a video before you leave? And it was like, you know, I forget what grade, I think it was eighth grade, ninth grade maybe. And anyway, I went back into a room. She was a neighbor, so it was trusted. It wasn't like stranger danger or anything. Okay, yeah,
this is getting a little weird.
Yeah, but she showed me a video. I still remember the name of it. It was called The Hard Truth. I wouldn't recommend it. But it showed the aftermath of abortion and hands and feet and faces. And that seared into my brain what was being allowed in our country. And in that moment, as a ninth grade boy, I was shocked that this was happening. And so I threw myself into pro-life movement down here. I've been on the board of Broward Right to Life before. And there was a season where some of the most famous figures in the abortion movement came to a seminar that I was at, and kind of serving as the do boy, getting waters and everything like that back in the day. But I remember one of them was Sandra Cano, which if you know the 73 Supreme Court case of Doe v. Bolton, which expanded abortion rights, she was there. She's now pro-life. Dr. Bernard Nathanson, who was the founder, one of the founders of NARAL, which is a National Abortion Reproductive Rights Action League or something like that. Mm-hmm. But he was there. And one of the fascinating things about him is he says the legalization of abortion back in those days came from lots of social pressure, and he talks about how they made up all the studies. Like, you know, the media would run and say, well, public polls say that such and such percentage support the legalization of abortion. He's like, we made all those up. We made up the narrative that there were 10,000 deaths of women in back alleys doing coat hanger abortions. He's like, totally no basis for that at all. We just made it up. You know, there were anecdotal things here and there. We just made it up and threw 10,000 at it. The media ran with it. And so it began to turn the tide of the conversation to where Roe v. Wade happened. Well, Roe v. Wade, the lady Jane Roe, just a fascinating story. Her name is actually Norma McCorvey. And she was pregnant, claimed to be raped, admitted later that she totally made that up, like that was a lie, and got an organization to take her case in Texas for the legalization of abortion in Texas, which at the time had abortion outlawed. So she claimed to be raped. The court case took too long. She had the child, put the child up for adoption. She's still alive to this day, the daughter. And she went on to be this great hero of the abortion movement. So she started working at an abortion clinic. And there were protesters outside that abortion clinic that would meet her every single day. And they would, you know, she said, I'd cuss like a sailor and we'd get in arguments and everything else. But one of the protesters had an 8-year-old girl named Emily that was the daughter. And I find this story really beautiful, actually. But the protester would allow Emily to go into the abortion clinic to get like drinks of water or whatever, and to talk with Norma, who was, I guess, at the front desk. And, you know, Norma McCorvey later says, you know, through all that season, my heart was so hard toward these protesters. You know, I'd cuss at them, but this little 8-year-old girl would come in, and she said one day she was on the phone and she was talking to somebody and they were complaining. And she said something like, well, I'll go to hell before I allow this to happen to the person on the phone. And Emily heard that. And with the innocence of an 8-year-old said, you don't have to go to hell, Miss Norma. You can pray right now and Jesus will forgive you. And she says that at that moment, her direct quote is, that childlike faith cut open my heart. And so then she agreed to come to church. She heard a sermon on John 3:16. And she gave her life to Christ. And she later wrote, she said, it made me feel so incredibly sorry for all my sins, especially my role in legalizing abortion. I just kept repeating over and over, I just want to undo all the evil I've done in this world. I'm so sorry, God. I'm so, so sorry. She says, finally, I stopped crying and broke into the biggest smile of my life. And I no longer felt the pressure of my sin pushing down on my shoulders. And today I'm 100% sold out to Jesus and 100% pro-life. And so she wrote that article. And I bring that up partly to say that the people that were most involved in bringing about abortion, their conscience weighed heavy. You know, they, for this lady's case, you know, millions of abortion that were permitted because of her court case. And I can't imagine wearing that burden, but there's something amazingly beautiful that when she goes to Jesus in that moment with all that guilt and all that burden and says, Lord, I'm sorry. In a moment, she felt relief. And like there, I have no doubt but that Jesus took all that from her and paid, you know, he paid for it on the cross and delivered her from that and gave her a new beginning and smiles over her and sings over her and dignified her life with a change. And there we go, the sanctity of a life redeemed, and it changed her life. And that's what the gospel does. That's the ethic of God. It's not just about don't kill. It's about elevating and exalting the dignity of human life, because we serve a God who makes us in his image. Our life belongs to him, and he is a God that loves for life to triumph over death. And in this case, even dead souls, when she cries out and says, I'm lost, I'm broken, I've done bad things, and Lord, I'm sorry, in a moment he can take all that away, grant you perfect righteousness, redeem you, and give you a life that is abundant in his name. And so there's always mercy out there. You've never committed a sin that's too great for the cross. Our job today, and part of the reason why we want to say things as straightforward as we do, is you have to wrestle with the truth. Like, the reality is each and every one of us has things that we have to go and wrestle with God and say, God, I'm sorry. Like, I have made a mess of things in a million different ways. And so this, more than anything, is an invitation for us as a culture, as people, to get back to recognizing the dignity and value of every life. That is a society that's good for everyone. You know, the Proverbs tell us to open your mouth for the speechless and in the cause of all who are appointed to die. And that's what this is about. Like, we're giving voice to the voiceless. I don't care where you stand on the issue of abortion. If you're a Christian, it should grieve you that 65 million unborn babies have had their lives taken. Nobody should be happy about that. Everybody should want to find solutions that keep that from happening. And in the early church, one of the things that I love reading about is suddenly there was dignity infused to every class of people, slaves and women and foreigners, and everybody had this infusion of dignity to their life, and it made society better. And one of the things that they did was they put an end to the practice of exposure, where if you had a baby that you didn't want, you could just leave them out in the elements for the creatures or for the sun or whatever, and you would just let the baby die. And when Emperor Justinian, who was a Christian, came along, he has the Justinian Code, and he put an end to exposure. But the logic behind it is beautiful. He says, those who expose children, possibly hoping they would die, and those who use potions of the abortionist, are subject to the full penalty of the law, both civil and ecclesiastical, for murder. Should exposure occur, the finder of the child is to see that he is baptized and that he is treated with Christian care and compassion. They may then be adopted as ad scriptatorium, even as we ourselves have been adopted into the kingdom of grace. That's the ethic of the gospel. God never forsook me. He adopted me when I was lost. Therefore, as a Christian, I'm going to go around and I'm going to look for the hurting and I'm going to look for the abandoned and I'm going to look for the forsaken and I'm going to adopt them with the same compassion with which God adopted me. I'm going to be a mirror of his goodness. And I'm going to try my best to hold life with the same dignity that our God has infused every creature from conception to death. He has infused them with that dignity. And we as his people should honor and revere that dignity. So that's where we're going to end it. Again, these are not pleasant to talk about because I know they're going to make people mad. But I feel like my conscience and the way that I understand who God is will not allow me to do anything different.
Yeah.
And so if you disagree, I hope that doesn't mean you hate us. You know, I want you to wrestle with God, wrestle with his word. And if you can come to a different conclusion than your conscience, I think you're wrong, but I still love you. And that's where we need to be as a culture. All right. Well, thank you for joining us. Remember, we are a people of life. Join us next time as we get into the seventh commandment and God's command not to engage in adultery, which also has a whole lot of elements to it. See you then.
We hope you enjoyed your time with us and you will both subscribe to the podcast and listen regularly. You can find out more about Out of Water, catch up on past episodes, and access show notes at our website, riovistachurch.com/out of water.